Penguin Random House Audio presents Tokyo Underworld, The Fast Times and Hard Life of an American Gangster in Japan by Robert Whiting. Read for you by Oliver Wyman. In memory of the late, great Kitty. Prologue. America's relationship with Japan began in 1853 when Commodore Matthew Perry and his squadron of black ships forcibly ended centuries of self-imposed isolation and opened up the nation to the rest of the world. For years afterward, however, the number of expatriate Americans who actually lived in that country at any one time was measured in the low hundreds. Those silk traders, oil merchants, teachers, missionaries, military attachés, and so forth, were almost totally segregated, socially and geographically, from the general population. The war in the Pacific helped change all that. When it was over, Japan suddenly found itself playing unwilling host to over 500,000 occupying soldiers and civilians. Historians called it the biggest meeting between two cultures since Rome took Carthage. The libraries are filled with historical tomes, doctoral theses, and personal memoirs recording the vast changes that resulted. The creation by starry-eyed New Deal Japan experts of a new constitution, the semi-successful attempt to introduce democracy, Japan's slow, painful metamorphosis from shattered nation to global economic power. The alliance also produced a considerable number of institutes, foundations, goodwill associations, academic departments, think tanks, libraries, endowments, trade agreements, treaties, sister cities, and thousands of reassurances of the two parties' essentially friendly and cooperative pursuit of peace, prosperity, and human happiness. But there is another side to the U.S.-Japan equation that is far less known, if inextricably bound up in the whole. It is an alternate, separate layer of reality, a shadowy universe of characters, gangsters, corrupt entrepreneurs, courtesans, seedy sports promoters, streetwise opportunists, intelligence agents, political fixers, and financial manipulators who perhaps have done as much in their own right to influence U.S.-Japan affairs as their more refined and respected peers. Significantly, it has not always been easy to distinguish the latter from the former. Japanese authors have written much about what they call variously the underground economy, the invisible empire, the shadow government, and the yamishakai, dark society, among other things, and have dealt at length with Americans' participation in it. However, the history of this chaotic orb and the efforts of Americans and Japanese to exploit, use, and abuse each other within it has largely remained untold in the West. Among the more notable byproducts of this dynamic subculture, for example, has been a post-war black market, perhaps unprecedented in character, a secret Wall Street cabal that subverted official U.S. policy in Japan, an extraordinary jingoistic professional wrestling boom enthusiastically promoted by a tandem of political leaders and underworld bosses and led by a national sporting icon with a hidden past, a ruthless Korean gang lord vying for control of the city, involved in a secret connection with the U.S. government and the CIA, a professional wrestler and Tokyo jewel thief named Gorgeous Mac, nightclub hostesses trained in the art of international industrial espionage, Lockheed, the granddaddy of all aircraft scandals, financial gangsters, an underworld stock market manipulator who nearly made it to the portals of the White House, assorted con artists, gold smugglers, and an American mafia boss of Tokyo from New York who founded one of the world's great night spots, where many of these characters congregated. This book tells the story of that bizarre demimonde. It is a parable of greed, arrogance, duplicity, and revenge that spans 50 years and bears many hidden layers in the U.S.-Japan relationship. The tale it tells parallels the great shift of wealth from America to Japan and more recent shifts back the other way. It reveals as much about the baser emotions that have united Japanese and Americans in the fashioning of the post-war era as it does the vast cultural differences that habitually separate them. Chapter 1. The First Black Market. Urgent notice to enterprises, factories, and those manufacturers in the process of shifting from wartime production to peacetime production. Your product will be bought in large quantities at a suitable price. Those who wish to sell should come with samples and estimates of production cost to the following address: Shinjuku Market, 1-854 Tsunohazu, Yodobashiku, Shinjuku, Tokyo. Kanto Ozogumi, August 18, 1945. It was surely some kind of record for speed. 3 days after the end of the war, and a full 10 before the first American soldier set foot in Japan, the preceding newspaper advertisement appeared for what would be the nation's first post-war black market. One of the very few paid announcements in print at the time, it was a call to commerce hardly anyone expected so quickly, given the wretched, bomb-ravaged condition of Tokyo. Once a teeming castle town of wood and paper houses, Japan's capital was now mostly cinder, the ground one massive flat layer of residue from the terrible B-29 Superfortress incendiary attacks. The heavily populated lowlands to the east by Tokyo Bay, where the merchant and artisan classes had lived and worked, had all but been obliterated, as had vast sections of the neighboring industrial city of Kawasaki and the port of Yokohama, further to the south. Drivers of what few cars there were frequently got lost because it was so difficult to distinguish the road from the rubble of shattered roof tiles and burned-out homes. All that was left standing were several marble and stone buildings in the commercial business centers of the capital, Marunouchi, Ginza, and Nihonbashi, which the occupation authorities were planning to use for themselves. For most of Tokyo's inhabitants, existence was a living hell. Homeless, numbering in the millions, lived in jerry-built huts of chicken wire, rocks, and cardboard, occupied subway stations and air raid shelters, or camped out in large bomb craters in the street. There was so little available food that people would travel hours to the countryside to trade expensive heirlooms for a tiny share of a farmer's crop. Yet by August 20th, only 5 days after Japan had officially conceded defeat, the Ozu open-air market was ready to roll. Located at the main entrance of the Western commuter hub Shinjuku Station, or what was left of it, it boasted a startling array of goods. Displayed on wooden crates were pots, pans, kettles, plates, silverware, cooking oil, tea, rice, leather, electrical goods, and geta, wooden clogs, along with vast quantities of military equipment and clothing. Most of the wares for the market, which bore the romantic-sounding name Hikari wa Shinjuku Yori, the light shines forth from Shinjuku, had been stolen from a secret supply of provisions for a ghost army of 4 million men that was to have been mobilized in the event of an American invasion of the mainland. The Potsdam Declaration had decreed that the Japanese government would have to surrender all such materials. However, with Japan in a weird post-surrender netherworld where no one was really in charge, looters appropriated an estimated 70% of all supplies held in military depots throughout the country, providing the Ozu market with its windfall inventory. The Kanto Ozugumi, Kanto Ozu Gang, was the largest crime syndicate in western Tokyo at the time, They were tekiya.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?